This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the CCWG Accountability Workstream 2 Jurisdiction Subgroup Meeting, number 31. Sorry, it says 30 there, but it is in fact 31, May 16th, 2017, at the hour of 0500 UTC, which is wonderful if you're in the Asia-Pacific region. I'm in New York City. Anyway, let us begin with a review of our agenda. After the usual administrative minute, we'll have a very brief follow-up on the question for ICANN Legal status, an even briefer review of decisions and action items from the last call, a more in-depth discussion of the questionnaire, as you can see from the chat, we will take item 6.2, the review of the response of the Ministry of Telecom and Mass Communications of the Russian Federation, and put that over to next week so that Tatiana Tropina, who is presenting that questionnaire response, can prepare a written evaluation in the general manner demonstrated by David McCauley. Tatiana has also graciously volunteered to take the one remaining unclaimed response, that of the Internet Governance Project, which was prepared by Farzana Fadi. Well, after the questionnaire, we'll move on to the review of ICANN litigation. We have one presentation there by yours truly of the Image Online Design case, then AOB, and then, of course, the next meeting, which is not Tuesday the 16th of May, 0500. Sorry, the agenda was done in a little bit of a hurry as I had a number of other critical items to take care of today and yesterday, and such is life. But we will confirm the accurate time. So that is our agenda. Any comments, changes, or the like on the agenda before we actually move through it? Seeing none, we will embark on our journey through the agenda. Moving to item number 3, administration. Are there any changes to statements of interest? Seeing none, I will ask if there are any audio-only participants. Caboose, please go ahead. Caboose, I'm not hearing you.
Hello?
Yes, I'm hearing you now. Please go ahead. Yes, I hear you.
Thank you very much. The last 10 minutes, I will be on audio. I have to leave 10 minutes before the end of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. We'll note that. We may not make it all the way to the end of the time anyway. In any case, we have no phone number participants, so that takes us through item 3 into item 4. Following up on the follow-up question for ICANN Legal, I have no new reports on status. I don't know if anyone from staff has any further knowledge of where we stand on getting a response back from Sam or anyone else, and ICANN Legal. See, we have Yvette and Patrick Dotson, but Bernie has been the one who's been bird-dogging this particular question, and Bernie is not with us this week, so, and neither is the response, so let's just assume that it is underway. And so shall we get underway to the next item. Review of decisions and action items from the last call. There were no formal decisions or action items. Obviously, continuing with the questionnaire response work and the litigation review work is always an action item for the group until it's done. So let us move on then to the next item, which is the questionnaire responses. And we'll begin with David McCauley, who will walk us through or discuss response provided by Rita Forsi, GAC representative from Italy. David, why don't I turn the microphone over to you? And I took your email and just put it into a document, into a PDF, which you now see in front of you. Take it away, David.
Thanks, Greg. David McCauley here, for the record. Excuse me. As we started into these responses to the questionnaire, I signed up for this one, as Greg just described it. And it is a response to the questionnaire in which Ms. Forsi, who is an official with the Ministry of Economic Development of Italy, she's the Director General, and she's the Italian GAC representative to ICANN. She raises an important issue, which is geo-indications. And as I mentioned, it's been an issue that's boiling in the ICANN community. It's been under review by a number of groups and continues to be. It's a sensitive issue and an important one, and she gives it a fair treatment. She answers a couple of the questions that we posed, but not all of them. And she basically makes the point that because ICANN was directly involved, as she says, in the dot line issue. And that issue is, as I said, concerns geographic indications. And Ms. Forsi makes a connection that I did not persuade me, but I mean it's what she argues, is that the recognition of the non-recognition, rather, of geographic indications as a principle by the United States, and consequently, which is an important word, I underscore the word consequently, and consequently by ICANN, making the point that because the United States does not recognize as a matter of law geographic indications, ICANN didn't as well, and that leads over to the ICANN treatment of geographic indications, and that by allowing for the delegation of a new top-level domain, generic top-level domain like .wine, would put at risk geographic indications that are protected in Europe. And she goes on and says that I believe it was the GAC brought two reconsideration requests. Well, I'm sorry, the government of Italy brought two reconsideration requests to ICANN complaining about the prospective delegation of .wine without further protections in the delegation. Both of them were rejected by ICANN, and she says that's an indication of how this also has affected the jurisdictional concepts that we're discussing. And she concluded by saying that you know, it's necessary that an independent third party study possible conflicts of laws and jurisdictions relating to the Internet and if warranted, consider options for action to prevent these kind of conflicts and solve them wherever they occur. In making the case, I took, in my analysis, the view that the .wine issue represents more of a policy discussion than a legal jurisdiction application. But I said that, to be fair, our question was asking about the effect of jurisdiction in any way, so I can understand the point. I simply felt that it was not impactful for our discussions here in this subgroup, and that's the conclusion that I came to and that I personally argue. It's a short and to the point entry by Ms. Forsi, so I would encourage everybody on the team to take a look at it. But with respect to my personal view, is I think it's, while it's an important issue, I just don't think it has much weight to move us in the jurisdictional discussion one way or the other. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, David. That's very helpful. I'd like to see if there are any comments from anyone. Caboose, please go ahead.
Yes. First of all, thank you, David, for the investigation or examining this case. David, I, as a member of the GAC, was involved in this issue from Beijing up to now. I think the GAC member of the USA mentioned several times that geographical indication is something outside the ICANN. It has not been yet dealt with on the WTO. Maybe at later stage changed her view. But that is the situation, and the issue is not only affecting Italy. Many other European countries, because a part of that complaint, and saying that there is no sufficient safeguard with respect to this issue, and the other three sides, they've been insisting that, and I do not believe that it is not 100% outside the jurisdiction. It might have some link, some lien with the jurisdiction. Should the ICANN was not as it is today, perhaps the situation was different. So thanks for your personal view, but that is only a personal view. My personal view is that it had some link with the jurisdiction, and it is a matter, similar things might have happened in the future. So we need to carefully look at that one to see to what extent this sort of thing has relations or lien with the jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. Any other comments on this? David, I see a question in the chat, and perhaps you can answer it. From Tiago Jardim. David, can you please develop again why you think it is a policy issue rather than a legal one?
Thanks, Greg. It's David again. And also, let me just respond to Caboose for just a second. And I agree with Caboose's summary that this is my personal opinion, and I make that very clear. I do, you know, since the question was how do jurisdictional concepts affect this or affect you in any way, I could see the argument. I'm just not persuaded. With respect to Thiago's comment, thank you very much. It's my sense that with respect to geographic indications, the application of U.S. jurisdiction in the U.S., assuming that Ms. Forsey is right, and I think she is, that there's a non-recognition or there's no legal principle in the U.S. that says geographic indications are protected in this respect. I don't think that means, therefore, I don't think that translates, therefore, to the fact that, therefore, because of that, that is ICANN's position. I personally believe that this came about as a part of the policy development discussion process that led up to the applicant guidebook for the new GDL program generally. And again, it's a personal opinion. I certainly understand that other people see this differently. But in trying to get this issue on the table, the issue is, as Ms. Forsey states it, and that's her position, and I respect it, as a person in this group trying to lead this discussion or put it on the table, it's simply my opinion that it is, you know, that it's not a jurisdictional application that led to this result. It's a policy discussion result, and I don't see this particular incident, the treatment of Dot Wine, the TLD, as implicating any action that the jurisdiction subgroup should take. So thank you for the comment, and that's I'm trying to make this clear. I guess I find it difficult, but it's at the end, it seems to me that this is not something that would move us one way or the other. Thank you.
Tiago, why don't you go ahead, even though I had my hand up since he's responding to you directly. I'll defer to you.
Thank you, Greg. This is Tiago Jardim for the record. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, David, for your answer. please help me understand this better. So what you're saying is that ICANN could, as of today, change the approach it has in relation to geographical names, even though let's assume that the United States government or the, according to U.S. laws, geographical names are not recognized. So ICANN could adopt a way of dealing with the issue while U.S. jurisdiction would command a different treatment of the same issue. Is that correct? Thank you.
This is David again for the record. I believe that that would be true, at least that's my personal understanding. That is that irrespective of U.S. law, if ICANN, the organization, as a result of the policy, of the community's policy, decided that top-level domains could not include names that would put at direct risk some geographical indications, I don't know that the U.S. law would require a different result. I think ICANN would be free to do that. That's my understanding. Thank you.
Thank you, David. It's just briefly, this is, in fact, as a policy issue being considered both in the rights protection mechanisms group and in the subsequent procedures, working group. In other words, the next round or procedures of new GTLD's working group, which is sponsoring multiple sessions relating to geographical indications and other geographic terms at the Johannesburg ICANN meeting upcoming. Just to clarify my understanding, the state of U.S. law, at least to the best of my understanding, U.S. law recognizes geographical indications as a form of trademark and will protect them under trademark law to the extent that they meet the requirements of trademark law, typically as a certification mark. Or sometimes as a collective mark. The U.S. does not offer so-called sui generis protection for geographical indications as a separate form of intellectual property. I believe it is certainly the position of the United States government that the U.S. Treatment of geographical indications meets its requirements under GATT/TRIPS. And in fact, the international treaty known as TRIPS does refer to geographical indications as a form of protected intellectual property. And there was a considerable back and forth after TRIPS was put in place, where there were contentions, I believe, by the EU that the GIs were not appropriately protected under U.S. law, and the U.S. taking the position that GIs were protected under U.S. law as trademarks. I would note that there are a number of jurisdictions where GIs are protected through trademark law and other jurisdictions protected under various forms of sui generis or unique protection, and still others where they may not be protected at all. In any case, I think the nub of the issue, David, is where you say that the de facto non-recognition of GIs by U.S., and let's assume for sake of argument, that's correct, though I disagree, and consequently by ICANN. I think the point that seems to be made there is that ICANN is somehow acting under U.S. law and is bound by U.S. law in some way or influenced by U.S. law with regard to how it treats GIs. Of course, ICANN is not bound by U.S. law in terms of how policy is set. And the issue, of course, with Dot Wine and Dot Vin was whether Appellation Contrôlée and equivalent types of geographical indications would have special protection, depending upon to whom the domain was top-level domains were delegated. So that was really what the issue was, whether second-level domains in Dot Wine and Dot Vin could be acquired by those who did not have the appellation. So, for instance, could I have acquired Champagne.Vin I'm clearly not a resident of the Champagne region or a Champagne producer, as that is known. So that was really where the question is, and it was one of the most brutally fought, maybe brutal isn't quite the right word, intensely discussed issue. As to whether it falls within the ambit of this subgroup, I think that goes back to our discussions of what is the scope of this subgroup. I think the question I would ask, David, is whether in any way there was a discussion of how this affected ICANN's accountability for its operation. And I'll stop talking now. Caboose, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you, Greg, for your very comprehensive, complimentary comments to David. The issue is not associated with the accountability as such. The issue is that can we draw a line between policy, trademark, and jurisdictions? Are not they connected to each other from one or other aspects? As you mentioned, that if I can have a policy today that makes some rules for the use of the geographical indication in order to avoid such a thing, and should one party who is interested, those countries, Australia, Canada, United States and others, they take the issue to the U.S. court, and the U.S. court would act on in what way? Would act against the United States law, which is enforced, but associate this to the trademark, but not to the not the formal recognition. In my view, it has some link. It has some relation. And perhaps other people involved in this should comment on that. There were a handful number of the European countries, all of them, France, Spain, Switzerland, and others. They were involved in that, Portugal and others in that issue, and only Italy has reacted. I'm not taking any position because we are not involved at all, but one could not say strictly it has no relation to the jurisdiction. It has some because the jurisdiction currently is governed, at least from the theoretical point of view, from the United States law. So that is the issue. So we could not draw such a line saying it's only policy. Policy has connection with jurisdiction. Jurisdiction has connection with the trademark. So we cannot take that. So we should look at that to see whether there are similar things and whether this jurisdiction should have some meaning. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. David McCauley, please go ahead.
Thanks, Greg. It's David McCauley again for the record. First of all, to your question, Greg, the response from Ms. Forzi, which I pasted into the email that I sent, didn't really speak about accountability in terms of in those terms. The other thing I wanted to say is I was grateful for your intervention about trademark law, which made me want to make it clear. I'm not an expert in international law or in trademark law, so I very much welcome your comments about, you know, what protections may or may not be available. And so I would encourage the group not to look to me as an expert in law in dealing with this. I'm giving you my personal opinion. And then finally, with respect to Iago's hypothetical, I agree with you, Greg, it is a hypothetical, but I also think it's fair to say that if the Dot Wine case ever ended up in a U.S. court, the outcome is not certain. As being against European interests, it's not a certainty because U.S. courts listen to amicus briefs, they listen to other points of view, and they are capable of applying bodies of law other than their own. So I don't think the issue is fully determined. I don't think we can say with 100% surety what would happen in a U.S. court if a case like that was brought up. But again, I want to underscore the fact that I'm not an expert in international law, in geo-indications, or in trademarks, so I was very grateful for Greg's intervention. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think we may want to come back to this in the course of discussing one of the other open issues, which we need to start turning to shortly, which is the scope of the and the specific assignment of this subgroup. Jurisdiction as a broad concept can bring in all sorts of things, but this group is not the group for all jurisdictional concepts. We'll to that. And I guess the question of what the dot wine or dot van case was in fact, would in fact have been, is an interesting one. As I understand it, the question was whether whoever was delegated, the TLD, was being, the demands were made that, they should run it in a restricted, manner, regardless of what, that, the registry's plans were for running that TLD. Obviously there were TLDs that were, where the registries decided to run, a secure or restricted or special purpose TLD, such as .bank, where only, entities that could prove they were in fact banks could register. I don't believe that initially the registry intended to operate in that manner. So that question, to my mind, was whether ICANN could be forced, if you will, to in turn force the registry to operate a restricted TLD due to the existence of geographical indications that affected that particular top-level domain. You have the same issue in .cheese, for instance, as well, which, you know, could come up in the future. So I guess the ultimate question is here is whether somehow the fact that ICANN has a lot of people located in the United States somehow influenced how ICANN handled the matter. And that's an interesting question. Actually, Tiago, it's not at all for, I see what Tiago says is what is for sure is that U.S. courts will apply U.S. laws and only eventually might rely on other countries' views for the purposes of interpreting U.S. laws. Tiago, we actually had quite a bit of discussion of that before you joined the group. That's not a correct statement of conflict of laws. In fact, U.S. Courts often apply the laws of other countries, and there is and so do other countries, in fact. And there is a global concept implemented differently in different countries called conflicts of laws where courts will decide based on well-stated principles which jurisdiction's laws will be applied. And indeed, that is in our litigation summary, one of the questions we ask is whether there is a conflict of laws analysis in the particular case. So we can go back to that, one thing that is for sure clear is that U.S. courts apply the laws of many different countries based on the facts and situations in those cases. In any case, that's enough for me. If I'm talking too much, then the meeting is not as good as it can be if I talk less. Anybody else? Tiago, please go ahead.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah, I understand that the U.S. Courts will apply other countries' laws, but I apologize for not having followed the previous discussions of the subgroup. But if you allow me to make a brief comment in relation to the ability of U.S. courts to apply other countries' laws, isn't it correct to say that a U.S. judge will, for example, apply Brazilian law only to the extent to that U.S. laws allow him, the U.S. judge, to do so. So in a way, even if American jurisdiction is applying the laws of a different country, it can only do so because U.S. laws allow them to do so. And to that extent, the U.S. judge is applying U.S. laws.
That's not quite correct. It's not a question of whether U.S. laws allow him to do so or her to do so. The question is whether the conflict of laws principles of the particular jurisdiction lead to the conclusion that the law of another jurisdiction, such as Brazil, are to be applied in that particular case. From there on in, the substantive law applied to come to a decision in the case are those of the other jurisdiction. For instance, I was involved in a case that involved items that were taken from Germany during the Second World War, actually changed hands in Germany, and the court, New York federal court determined that German law covered the question of whether the transfer was a legal transfer or an illegal transfer. And each of the parties had brought in a German law expert, and the court in turn also had a German law expert, and the case was briefed under German law, and the judge consulted his German law expert, and between all of the experts and the judge, the decision was rendered under German law. So in that case, the only U.S. law that was applied was the law of conflicts of laws, which is by definition the law that has to be applied when you go to a particular venue to seek a remedy. One of the questions that will be raised by the parties is which law applies, and that is decided under conflicts of laws principles, which while they are, of course, the law of the particular jurisdiction, there are only a few different types of application globally in most countries. So it's not that the concepts are unique. In any case, we could veer off into conflicts of laws for quite some time, but let's not. Is there anything further on no, it's not the local jurisdiction's law. It's only the conflicts of laws analysis called for by the local jurisdiction. The substance of law of the case will be the case, will be the law of that is decided, for instance, German law or Brazilian law. And given the fact that different countries tend to apply conflicts of laws relatively similarly, if that case were brought in Belgium or the Belgian Congo or, which doesn't exist anymore, apologies to what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Japan, it's fairly likely that the law of Germany would have been applied in the case I talked about. So we can certainly go into how conflicts of laws are dealt with in different countries, but again, I think that is a rabbit hole we don't need to go under. It would be interesting, perhaps, something to talk about over a caipirinha sometime. Any further comments on the 4C response? Seeing none, let's go back to the agenda. And thank you, David, for that presentation, and thank you all for the lively discussion. And apologies for speaking at greater length than I would like. Okay, so as noted earlier, we will have Tatiana Tropina present next week so that she can prepare a written analysis rather than just doing an oral walkthrough of the Russian Federation response. And thank you, Tatiana. And hopefully we'll have at least one or two other presentations available by that time. Is there anybody on this call who volunteered to do an evaluation who can say now that they will be ready in 1 week's time to present their case, their evaluation of the response? Obviously, Tatiana is a yes. Tatiana will present both cases that she has volunteered to do. And I see multiple attendees are typing. If we could bring up the sign-up sheet, if that was in the package. Tatiana is ready, but not in writing. Caboose, please go ahead.
Yes, Greg, I have a simple question perhaps you may for next week or week after. From those cases which were analyzed by colleagues before, have you identified anyone having connection with jurisdiction, or in your view, none of them have any connection with the jurisdiction at all? Because the case of today, you and David, they are of the view that has nothing to do with the jurisdiction. It is maximum the policy. So for those cases we have already analyzed, have you had a chance to look at them to see which one of them associated or connected or liaised with the with the jurisdiction, or we have the same case as of this dot wine and dot one?
Caboose, I have not. I'll look at each case as it's presented by the evaluator, and consider them. This particular case I took on its or this response I took on its own merits with an open mind, as I do with each. Yvette, actually, I meant the other sign-up sheet, the one for the evaluation. Thank you. Okay. Here we have the list of responses. Perhaps next week, depending upon time, I'll be ready to talk about the those that are listed in pink here, which are those that were basically the one word or ultra short responses. So we'll look at those as a group. We have the green ones. Eric Schweighofer who is on this call. I'm wondering, Eric, if you'll be ready, at least, if not next week, in 2 weeks' time, to present your evaluation. Since Tatiana will probably take a good amount of what we would put to that. Thank you, Eric. Eric says, okay. So we'll put you in the queue for 2 weeks from now. And then we have Christopher Wilkinson, who's not on this call, doing the just recently signed up for the JustNet Coalition response, which is quite a lengthy one. Farzana Badi's comment, actually done by the Internet Governance Project, but she was the author. Tatiana Tropina now signed up for that one, so that's covered. Rita Forsey, we have already heard about. Then going down to the other green ones, we've discussed the Russian Federation. Parminder has volunteered to evaluate and present the .swiss domain registry. And finally, Vidushi Marda, that of the Internet Governance Research Center, the Chinese Academy. So I believe that covers all that we received. Do note, however, there are five that are listed in yellow or orange, and those are the ones that are borderline. We need to decide if they will be analyzed. Hopefully, the evaluation group, those most of whom are listed in the third column, can perhaps come to some recommendations. If not, we'll essentially review them together and see what we have to say about analyzing them. I don't want to spend too much time on deciding whether they should be analyzed. The fact of the matter is that they're all fairly short, and whatever analysis that will be involved will be less than that, for instance, of the one we discussed today. Caboose, is that a new hand?
Yes, a new hand. This is a question that I raised last time. I did not receive a complete answer. The cases that have question marks are still under the study to see whether they should be analyzed or not. But those who have the no, that means the pink or whatever color you call, does it mean that those cases are because of one word reply or because of any other things that we put no? And then I see on the right-hand hand column, it is Greg, that means you decided to be no, or their team will check whether really they should not be analyzed. And I don't understand why a case, apart from being yes or no, so simple, why it should not be analyzed. So this is just a clarification. I'm not objecting. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. I think the suggested result, which, of course, we could revisit if we want, was that since these were all basically one-word answers to the questions, that a separate lengthy or separate substantial analysis would not be necessary. However, the answers will be duly taken into account as part of our overall analysis of the questionnaire responses. And either the questionnaire evaluation response team or this subgroup will need to decide how we will evaluate these in the aggregate, understanding that this is by no means a representative survey. There's no distribution here that is meant to represent any be a particular population. This is just those who happen to respond. There's no, great statistical overall analysis that can be made of the 20 responses here and come to some grand conclusion. That's at least in my personal opinion. But we will, of course, take each of these into account. And in looking at those to be analyzed together, for which I volunteered, we'll look at them and see if there's something to be said either individually or in the aggregate about these responses. So that is, I think covers this point. It covers the questionnaire. So why don't we move on to the next back to the agenda? And while we're doing that, I see a follow-up comment from Tiago in the chat. Perhaps it would be a good idea to give Ms. Forsey the opportunity to comment on David's analysis to her questionnaire, if that's not already the case, in which case I apologize for raising the issue. So that's something to consider, whether we want to give. First off, David's analysis is only a suggestion. There's whatever analysis we come to will be some understanding of the group. And I guess the question is whether we would, invite every respondent into kind of engage in a point-counterpoint of their responses. That's something for the group to consider. And I don't have an instant reaction to it other than some concern about time frame. But that's something we should consider. Why don't we make that kind of an action item for next week to consider that point. So let us move on then to the review of ICANN litigation. To put the sign-up sheet back up briefly for this, we'll take a look at our progress in this regard. There it was. In any case, we've made some progress in terms of several more of the litigations being claimed, and that means that there are several more that are in the analysis phase. So we'll say between last week and this week, four more were claimed, but that still leaves 15 unclaimed. So we've crossed over the 50% threshold, but given how long we've been doing this, that's not actually particularly wonderful. We've had 11 that have been covered, 10 actually, as one will be covered today, and then 9 that are in the analysis phase. So we may want to consider how to deal with these remaining 15 if we don't get volunteers to look at them. And I note that David McCauley has volunteered to do several, and I thank David for his yeoman efforts. I'll also note that Mathieu Vile did 3, but he is, of course, no longer with the group. So we can't count on him anymore, unfortunately. So I will ask again, anybody who can give it a shot, please try to do an analysis. In any case, let's move on to the case of the day, which is the image online design case, and if Yvette, you could put up the summary. I apologize for not sending this out until relatively recently. Perhaps we want to discuss it a little more next week, but let's begin. the Image Online design case involved a litigation in 2012, but the facts really bring us back to 1996, when Image Online design began operating .web as an alternate route TLD, not through the DNS. In the 2000 round, they applied to make .web a DNS TLD through ICANN, but at that time, no operator was chosen, and indeed they decided not to go forward with a .web as a potential DNS TLD at that time. Image Online Design went on operating .web as an alternate route TLD until the new gTLD round that is just winding up started. And they contended that their prior application in 2000 entitled them to be part of the consideration there without any further act on their part, which was not what the new gTLD rules called for. Basically said that any applicant from the 2000 round would be given a $50,000 credit for their $50,000 application fee from back in 2000. But would otherwise have to reapply. I believe that's the case. In fact, Image Online Design did nothing to reapply, and of course, when the application window closed, they were not one of the applicants for .web. So, as you can see, both plaintiffs and ICANN are California corporations. And the case took place in the U.S. Federal District Court for the Southern District of California. It did involve a contract, which was essentially the new TLD registry application form from the 2000 round, plus a number of additional documents, which were incorporated by reference into the application form, and which together formed a contract once assigned by both parties. A contract which was binding as to certain things, and specifically said it was not binding with regard to other items. There was no choice of law provision in any of those documents. So there was nothing stated in any of the court papers as to a law used to determine conflict of law issues, but since you had two California parties and a contract which was executed in the state of California, there really was no conflict of law question at the time. The substantive law governing the dispute was U.S. Federal trademark law, the Lanham Act, for the trademark matters in the case, and California law for the contract claims and related interference claims. As you can see, the case began on October 17, 2012, and ended February 7, 2013, so not very long by standards of U.S. litigation. There were a number of causes of action. Breach of contract for the reasons mentioned. Breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. There was no such covenant in the case, but in most U.S. jurisdictions and certainly in California, there is an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. At least arguably, in every contract, and they were basically attempting to enforce that implied covenant. Then they claimed trademark and service mark infringement because .web, or rather IOD, had received a registration for .web from the USPTO, but the goods and services were mouse pads and backpacks. Not registry services. And they also claimed trademark and service mark infringement under 1125A, which is basically the unfair competition, what's called 43A by most people. And last, they made two claims, intentional interference claims, one for contractual relations and another for prospective economic advantage. So if we could, I'd move to the second page. of the summary. Most of what you see at the top part there, I've already gone over. That was what the case was, which is to say, you know, more, a little bit more. They claim that IOD claimed that if .web was contested or even allowed to go forward as a potential domain, that would be a breach of the contract with ICANN, and also would constitute trademark infringement and also infringe the common law trademark rights under 43A that they claim they had, and that allowing .web to be offered to other parties would be intentional interference with their Image Online's contracts with its registrants, and also with its future registrants. That would be the prospective business advantage claim. So IOD asked for a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction to prevent ICANN from going forward with the .web TLD in the new GTLD program. In the papers, there's no reference to the temporary restraining order actually being argued, and the case was dismissed because ICANN filed a motion to dismiss, which was successful, and that basically closed down the case before the preliminary injunction request was considered. So in addition to the preliminary injunction, IOD asked for damages. I asked for ICANN's profits resulting from their alleged infringement of the .web mark, and an accounting and disgorgement of amounts for that, by which ICANN was unjustly enriched. And then they claimed that this was all willful infringement, which would multiply all the damages by three, treble damages, so three times as much money. And they also asked for punitive damages and exemplary damages, basically damages as punishment rather than compensation, and damages to make an example out of ICANN and not just for compensation. And also for a permanent injunction forever, keeping ICANN from delegating .web to anybody but Image Online Design, and finally asked for attorney's fees and costs. Fairly quickly, ICANN filed a motion to dismiss the case. And the court dismissed the case on all of the claims made by IOD, basically saying that there was no they failed to state a claim for breach of contract. There was nothing in the contract that actually prevented ICANN from doing what it did. The statutory trademark claims were unripe, which means that there was no activity yet that occurred that would give rise to a claim, and they also indicated that there was no likelihood of confusion, and in fact, IOD failed to present a coherent argument or any argument at all on likelihood of confusion. They also decided that .web was not a common law trademark, that there was no trademark rights in .web for registry services, and it was essentially generic at that time. So basically, IOD walked away empty-handed from this case. So the relevance of the case to the jurisdiction subgroups mandate, I think it's notable that the U.S. federal court did provide a forum for IOD to seek to hold ICANN accountable for what it believed to be improper actions of ICANN. They did not succeed, but that's part of what happens. It's notable that under U.S. law, IOD was able to do this without a significant risk of cost shifting, since the U.S. is not generally a loser-pays jurisdiction. So that, to some extent, encourages plaintiffs to seek to hold the defendants accountable, or what they see as accountable. Basically, if you look at the papers, you can see that the standards by which the matters were decided were seem to be fairly clearly stated in the U.S. law, which I think was helpful in getting the case decided. the impact of the case on ICANN's operations. Basically, it protected ICANN from what I would see as, or at least what the court saw as, interference, essentially, by the operator in the .web TLD. I did not answer the impact if case were decided for the other party. I'll add that, but basically, if it had been, then .web would essentially have been either available only to IOD, or IOD would have been added into the contention set for .web, probably more likely the latter. The court did not make any comments on any jurisdiction-related matters, and given that they dismissed the case for failure to state a claim, they didn't say that anything lacked merit. Oh, they said a couple of things lacked merit. They didn't find anything frivolous. But they felt that, as I said before, the likelihood of confusion argument, or the fact that there was no argument, pretty much doomed the trademark infringement claim, and the fact that they found that the argument that .web was a trademark, a common law trademark for registry services, because IOD had been offering .web as an alternate root TLD, they found that that was not a did not agree and did not find .web to be a trademark for registry services in IOD's hand. If they had, they might have decided that IOD was, as a trademark holder, the only company that could run a .web TLD. But the decision, which I think was correct under the circumstances, did not come out that way. In any case, that is the case. I don't know if anybody has any questions about this in the minute or two that we have left. Nothing. I think one of the interesting things underlying this is, of course, the whole alternate route issue, which I think just came up in the last couple of weeks yet again. Not so much a jurisdiction question, but it is always an interesting question about one internet or many. So seeing nothing further on this matter, which was fairly straightforward from a jurisdictional point of view, and it being 2 p.m., I'll see if there's any other business. I'll note just briefly that Finn Peterson, Denmark Jack representative, has volunteered to send David's analysis on to Rita Forsey. And since, of course, all of our work is open, it's available to be viewed by anyone. That's not a problem. Of course, we'll have to consider, as I said, how we might deal with interventions from outside the group. That's a different question from the issue of that's raised here. But let's not discuss that now, because it's now 2:01, and for most of us, it's high time. We either go to sleep or move on to whatever part of the day it is for you. So I will call this meeting adjourned. Thank you all for your participation, and ask that the recording be stopped, and I will see you next week at what time is it again for next week? I don't. Yvette, can you remind me? 1300 UTC, yes. Slightly more.
1300 UTC. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Well, let's stop the recording, and we'll see you in 1 week plus a few hours. Good night and goodbye.